Good evening. My name is Shannon D, and I am an alcoholic. Welcome to the Pacific Group Alcoholics Anonymous. The format of this meeting is two 10-minute speakers and a main speaker. Our first 10-minute speaker is Montea R.
Hi, I'm Montea and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, Mary, for asking me to speak at my home group. I'm really thrilled to be here. I guess I'll just start by saying what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I'm from a really small town in New York called Harlem, really just quiet place. It's quaint. That's my one joke, so enjoy it. I grew up in Alcoholics Anonymous, which was a ton of fun. I always love when I see kids in AA because, you know, when you come to AA meetings as a kid, you always have really great stuff to say on the playground the next day, like really interesting stories. And, you know, the thing that's great about that is that when we talk about God doing for us what we can't do for ourselves, I definitely understood at an early age that Alcoholics Anonymous worked. I didn't really know what was going on, but I knew inherently it was a positive place. And so when I ended up coming here, I could trust that, you know, Ronnie used to say, like, you can believe what we say here. I started drinking around high school. I wasn't naturally interested in alcohol, but my life had gotten kind of crazy. You know, my mom had gone out at that point, and I was so just sort of like checked out at that point. And so I tried alcohol not knowing that what I would experience was a type of relief I didn't know that I needed. I still love drinking. I had a lot of fun at first. It was a little weird sometimes, you know. My friends would go to parties and want to like get tipsy and flirt with boys, and I just kind of didn't really speak that language. For me, like, kissing seemed unsanitary. But I was happy to crawl in the gutter at Canal Street at 1 a.m. and find a cigarette and smoke that. But I don't know. I guess we're all just out here for different things. I started off drinking like Smirnoff Ice, right? I guess that's like White Claw of the 2000s. But very quickly, you know, that escalated. And, you know, when you're in high school and you shouldn't be drinking, what it tends to look like is high proof, right? So I started drinking Everclear before first period. I like to drink, like, I like to have two drunks a day. I like to wake up really early and get really drunk and fantasize just by myself, and then I like to pass out and drink again and try to live out those fantasies. Fantasies and drinking sort of went hand in hand for me. I will just skip to the one thing that I think is important to say about drinking. You know, I had one of my first sponsors, Lisa Johnson, used to be in this group, and when I was new, she used to always point out aspects of my behavior, and she would go, that is alcoholism. And I never really knew what she was talking about. But I'll say one thing that sort of like exemplifies that. You know, I got to college and I had sort of scammed my way in. I didn't have a high school diploma, but I just sort of arrived and dared them to ask me to leave. And that sort of, you know, happened for a while. I was in college, but, you know, one of these things was not like the other. My friends were excited and new to drinking, and I had a bleeding ulcer and I was really tired, and I started to feel that separation between me and my fellows. But my grandmother, who largely raised me when I was getting sober, when my mom was getting sober, she started to get dementia. And, you know, the story that I told the world was that, oh, poor me, I have to leave school and take care of her. But in reality, you know, her house was an opportunity for me to live somewhere for free and drink without any sort of objection. And so I moved in, and there were some sort of shady conditions around that. You know, I was asked to give her some medication that was unprescribed, and I did that for years, right? And this is someone who's incredibly dear to my heart. And as someone suffering from dementia, occasionally she would have lucid moments, and she would say, like, you know, my food tastes funny, or are you putting something in my food, or are you drinking in the house? You know, and I couldn't bring myself to tell her the truth. When I thought about giving up the conditions that allowed me to drink the way I wanted to, I just couldn't. And so I poisoned her for years. You know, I used to party a lot. In New York, I used to party with, like, party promoters who get paid to bring people to clubs. And it was absurd and it was ridiculous. I was not, you know, it just fit into the kind of fantasy that I wanted my drinking to be about. And one day I came back from partying and I gave my grandmother breakfast. And when I left the room, she started having a seizure, and the knife that I'd put on the tray, she fell on. And, you know, I'd gotten into a lot of trouble drinking. I'd sort of go to jail seasonally, right? And, like, that wasn't a big deal, but this was something I instinctively knew I wasn't going to get out of really easily. And, you know, the thing about that and the real alcoholism is that I started freaking out. You know, I'm sort of hysterical, and emergency services, like, you need to calm down. Luckily, she was taken to a nursing home immediately, but my performance of shock and surprise continued on long after she was taken out of the house. And you know, the reason for that is that I have to convince myself that my behavior is happening to me and it's not something that I'm doing. But about 5 or 10 minutes later, I sort of looked around and I was like, oh wait, I now have a free 2-bedroom apartment in New York City. And I like wiped off my eyes and I was like, fine. And for years after that, for maybe like 2 or 3 years, I just sort of like drank with no thought of the fact that I had that strange mental twist. And when we talk about phenomenon of craving, you know, I wasn't drunk every single day, but something switched in me that day where I, both sober and drunk, I was completely lost to alcohol. And I would have moments every so often where I would resurface and I would look around my life and I would go, this is not right. Like, this is weird. But I didn't really have the presence of mind to do anything about it. And, you know, those could have been windows of opportunities. And who knows why I didn't take them then, and who knows why I took the one that I finally did. I ended up in Oregon on a sort of last chance job, and again, was not like my fellows. You know, they were ambitious and smart and hardworking, and I was like slumped over most of the time. And I, you know, long story short, decided to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. My mother, it was basically like, I'm not one of your little friends. You can either go get sober or never call me again. And thank God for her being non-sentimental, because I went to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought, I'd never really tried to stop drinking, and I thought that it was going to be easy. And when I first got there, I sort of thought I was losing my mind. The inability to not consume a beverage when you don't want to feels like insanity. Like I could not get my head around the fact that I couldn't stop. I'll just sort of speed it up. I got a home group and a sponsor and a big book. I like to get in and like follow all the rules and be a good girl so I can like go behind the scenes and do a bunch of dirt. And so I like, you know, was acting up. I wanted to sleep with people. I wanted all the commitments. I just like, I was used to operating in a way where I got into the center of things and used everyone up. And then once you were tired of me, I could just flee to the next thing. And, you know, I'd been in all sorts of like Buddhist meditation groups and like just all these scenes. My friend calls me an investigative journalist because I just sort of like arrive places, get into it, and then flee. And I think that I thought maybe that was going to be what Alcoholics Anonymous was for me. But I drank on and off for 2 months. The night I got sober, I'd been in this really inappropriate relationship with someone at work who was much higher up and much older than me. And he called me on Christmas Eve and said, hey, do you want to go on a date? And when he arrived to pick me up, his girlfriend was in the front seat. And I remember thinking like, something isn't right here. Like there's information that I missed about this situation that now I'm sober for. And, you know, we went to dinner and like, so weird. They told me how they were going to Morocco in the morning and that they kissed, and I was holding a cup of tea because I don't drink, and like it fell out of my hands, and I just like I don't know why it was this moment and not all the others that I should have, but I was just like, what if I just didn't drink tonight over this? What if I just went to my AA meeting in the morning and like just tonight tried to stay sober? And that was the beginning of my sobriety. That first sponsor I had was incredible to me. You know, I chose her because she had a lot of money, and I thought that this, like, frankly, this older white woman's going to feel really bad for me, right? And she had cancer, and she had survived cancer and had Parkinson's, and she would drive me to the meeting every morning that was 5 blocks from my house at 5:30 in the morning, and she would call me and say, you know, you don't have to drink again if you don't want to. And I would be rolling a blunt on the phone and be like, whatever. And, you know, I thought that that woman, I thought that, again, as usual, I was in charge of the situation, right? But in reality, she was just a sober woman rolling out the red carpet for a newcomer, right? She saw me for exactly what I was and just was kind in spite of that. I fired her. She had an expensive puppy when I read my fifth step and she was petting it and I was super jealous. And I was like, if you're not going to listen to my fifth step, I got to get out of here. I think my time is probably like coming up, so I'll just speed forward. You know, I fired her and I got Lisa as my sponsor, and Lisa was appalled at what I'd done, and she made me make an amends, right? She made me sit down to Amy and say, like, what I did was terrible. I took advantage of our relationship. How can I make it right? And of course, you know, the worst thing is that she wasn't mad at me. But the next day I felt a little like a little of that tightness in me loosen, right? Like that was the first thing a year and a half into AA that I'd done where I felt a real deep relief. And so, you know, I'm in the home group the next day and I'm like, guys, if you want to talk about working steps, come see me. Like, I'll get you sober. Which is like the worst. I'm so glad I didn't get sober in Pacific Group, because I would have just embarrassed myself endlessly. Not that that matters. AA in general is very welcoming. But that was my experience, just sort of like having a real experience with working the steps. You know, I'm two steps forward, one step back. Lisa asked me to do some things that were very simple that I just didn't want to do, because deep down I couldn't get my head around the fact that I just didn't want to take a direction from someone else. That idea of really letting her put my hand in God's was unacceptable to me. And so, you know, she fired me. She told me that I was too sick to be in her life. And I remember being appalled, but also listening like, oh, I didn't know that was possible. I didn't know you could like set boundaries like that. And that's my experience with really strong sponsorship, is that I'm both really deeply like offended by the idea of what you're telling me, but on a deep level knowing like this has the potential to change my life. And I'm really glad that I've just hung around and hung in with that type of direction. It's time for me to stop. Okay, thanks.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Victor M.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Victor, alcoholic. Oh, I wish I sat upstairs. This is way weirder than speaking on Zoom, let me tell you. So I like to start off by thanking Mary for catching me at the door. Probably the most nerve-wracking thing I could ever go through when you're trying to rush into the meeting. You know how many times I've tried to just run in and like, they're not going to get me this time. But they did. And I'm grateful that I'm here. So I'll start off by saying that I come from a family that cared a lot. And I'm sure you all know that. And I was definitely a problem child. So my dad is a Mexican, my mom is German Jew, and I'm adopted from North Florida. And from the start, I was already confused. I didn't know, it was just awkward being in that family, even though like I was grateful when I was a kid. I had no idea what I was doing as a kid. When I was little, I was one of those kids that drank rubbing alcohol and cut his own hair without his mom knowing. And she probably has no idea that I did that. But I was a problem from the start. In kindergarten, my teacher said that I was going to be an issue growing up, and I was at 5 years old. That was probably not the best thing to tell a mother, when their kid is just five. But you know, through school, I continued to be a problem child, but I didn't know why. I hung out with kids that, I thought they were friends. You know, I went to a Jewish school in Northridge. I'm from the Valley. I know a lot of people don't like that. But my whole upbringing was very confusing. I was very lost. My parents had no idea what was wrong with me. I would not study. I would not listen. I wouldn't obey. I didn't even know. I didn't know what was wrong with me. So they took me to psychiatrists, psychologists. They put me on like ADD meds, and that made me concentrate on like totally other things other than school. And then it was interesting. But then I started drinking early on in high school. You know, at the age of, I don't even know, maybe 13. I don't remember, but I probably need it sooner. And it was a lot of fun. I used to go to my friend's house on the weekends, and his parents had a full bar. And he had a shot glass, had to build shots on his door. And I took the advantage. I was like, okay, we're going to try that one, we're going to do that one. And I just remember this one called the Iguana. I don't remember what was in it. It was strong. I was like, that one's strong. Cool. We're going to do all of these, but I'm going to do them all. And it turned into such a mess where I went there every weekend just to get drunk. And I thought it was fun. We would just laugh and roll around on the floor and watch Pink Floyd music videos and, I don't know, do weird things too. But it got to a point where he didn't want to, like, give me alcohol anymore. And I'm like, 13, 14, like, why are you so concerned? He started to pitch an idea. I was like, well, if I tase you, you could take a shot. And I was like, okay, that sounds like a good idea. And so it ended up being like that. And then I got in trouble because a lot of outside issues, and they turned into some rats, and I got in trouble, and they didn't. So I didn't think that was too fair. So I stopped hanging out with them. But later on, you know, I got into more outside issues to enhance drinking, and that was still in high school. I hung out with some wrong kids. I got jumped. I come from the mean streets of West Hills. Like, it was so difficult growing up. But I mean, I learned early on that was not a group to hang out with. I pushed them aside. I decided to get good grades senior year, and I wanted to get A's, and it was complete 180. And this is cool. 5 minutes. Then I went off to high school. So like then I went off to college. Sorry. I learned structure. I attempted to learn structure throughout my whole life. It was implemented in my life since I was born. My birth mom was an alcoholic. The parents that raised me are in AA, and now I'm in AA. So regardless of like where you come from, anything could happen. College was free. It was like a, you know, you take a drink, you get the moment. That was like going to Florida. I was like, I could finally relax. I could be away from my parents. But it didn't work in my favor. You know, I partied so hard. It was so much fun. Miami was very welcoming, and I learned a lot of things about Miami and not to go north, just stay south. But there was an incident that happened at my school where there was a humanitarian group that went out to Haiti, and that was when the Haiti earthquake happened. And four students and two teachers died. And one of them that survived was my roommate. But we didn't know. So I just continued drinking. It was a 2.5 week program, and I just drank. I never drank like that before. And I was just, that's when it really got out of control. After that, I got bad grades. I flunked everything. I got 109 credits, and they're useless. I did really well at the beginning of my schooling, and I just like screwed off the end of it. And I was like, yeah, I'm not going to do this anymore. So I became a photographer in Miami, doing nightlife photography, just getting drunk the whole time, not knowing what I'm doing. And I thought it was fun. I was like, this is a great time. I get to get into clubs for free. I drink for free. And then I'm like, I could attempt to take photos. You know, work is last. Drinking is first. But that went on for way too long. I was in Florida for like 8 years. I don't know how I survived. And I came home about 5-6 years ago. My parents were like, all right, come home. Come to a stable home and we'll sort this out. And what ended up happening was outside issues took over. And I adventured into the LA night scene, which was not as fun because it ended short. Because Miami, you could go all day, and then keep going, and then keep going, and then it's Monday. Those outside issues really, man, shadow people are crazy, and they were my friends. I thoroughly enjoyed them while I was thoroughly freaking out. But that got really out of hand by 2017. My ex-girlfriend cheated on me, and then I went into a 4-month downward spiral, and that's when I was introduced to AA at an H&I panel in a mental institute. I slept next to schizophrenics. I got to know some crazy people, and lo and behold, I was one of them. And you know, I danced around AA, you know, my whole life, not knowing what I was and what I would become. But thankfully, you know, when things got crazy again, you know, I almost got a year sober in a sober living, but with no program. So I was just angry all the time. And I went out not too long after when I went home and went crazy. And I decided to embrace AA again. And I never knew how much AA gave back. I never understood the concepts of AA and what it was for, what it does, and how it helps you. And like, it was a program that helps you. And I didn't grasp that concept. Like, I used to write myself notes on my phone. I'm like, what is wrong with me? I don't understand. Why can't I get this program? Do I really want to be honest? Do I want to be rigorous, honest? And, you know, I met my sponsor at Ohio Street, and, you know, he took on my case, and I'm forever grateful that I got commitments. He threw me in the middle. I had no choice. And 10 minutes is really short because I was sweating in the back. I feel like I could talk for 30 minutes. But, you know, I'm thankful for being here, and I'm very grateful that I'm sober, and I'm thankful for you guys. Thank you.
Our main speaker tonight is Charles K.
Charles alcoholic. Is that my water? No? That's for the kid. Okay. I want to thank Monte and Victor for speaking tonight. This is weird looking at myself on a screen. We live in interesting times, don't we, with Zoom going on. And I want to thank them for carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous to me while I sat there and was self-obsessed. I've already heard what I needed to hear tonight. You know, in the AA meeting, thank you. I mean, I just as soon actually sit back in my seat and hear more about Montea's date, to be honest with you, than... I'm serious. I was thinking that guy's got game, right? I mean, that's guts. I'm going to ask this girl out on a date, and I have a girlfriend, and then I'm going to show up with my girlfriend. I didn't have guts like that, but I want to thank Mary for asking me to talk and for doing a great job in these in these, you know, this time we're living in, and just being a great role model and absolutely keeping the traditions of our group. I having been a past secretary, I can't imagine like having to deal with all the extra stuff that she's dealing with, you know, during COVID and everything else. I remember when, you know, like only in AA, people are like, oh, wow, you're the secretary of the Pacific Group, right? And when I got elected, it was like, you know, people were so enamored by that. And I thought, you know what, I'm the guy that gets to drive the short bus for the next year. That's it. You know what I mean? Like, I looked at it like that. And I'm still on the bus. I'm just driving for a year. And but every one of those secretaries, however they've driven the bus, has kept the tradition strong in our home group. And I think Clancy would be extremely proud of the job that Mary's doing. And everybody here is doing, considering the times we're living in. I miss him a lot, especially in our steering committee meetings, because he made our steering committee meetings very quick and to the point. And now we have a lot more to talk about. It seems as though he's not around. And but I'm super grateful to be sober. I'm grateful my sponsors in the room, Tim Kay. I'm grateful the guys I play cards with are in the room. You know, I've been sober with a group of guys who I play cards with, you know, the entire time I've been sober. It's been like 27 years, and most of us, I think all of us are still sober. You know, all of us were new or fairly new at one time or new to the group, and we still get together regularly and see each other, and that group has grown from other people in the Pacific group, but that core is still there. And when I step into a room and I see those gentlemen, it gives me a sense of ease and comfort that helps me in situations like this. I absolutely didn't want to talk tonight. I got a lot of stuff going on in my life that I'm not really comfortable with right now. And it seems like the Wednesday night meeting, I always get asked to talk, like when I'm in some big crisis in my life. You know, they couldn't ask me to talk when I got a pocket full of 50s and the wind at my back, right? It's like, oh, hey, you know, this or that, let's watch the train wreck. Let's ask Charles to talk. And I'm never the one to get up here and not to be honest about what's going on in my life either. And that's the hard part for me. So I have no idea where this night's going to go. I haven't talked in quite some time, especially behind a podium. But I'm super grateful, like I said, of those gentlemen in the meeting tonight, and to see like a lot of the old timers, to see Johnny here every week with Larry and all my friends who are sitting out there. It just brings me a sense of ease and comfort knowing that I'm here in person. And so I'm the youngest of six kids. Was born in L.A., raised in an L.A. city housing project. And I don't know if you clap about that or not, but I was raised in an L.A. city housing project. I have four older sisters and an older brother. My dad was an alcoholic, and my dad was a Korean War veteran. He was an Army Ranger who spent like 128 days behind enemy lines during the Korean War. I got a write-up from General Ridgway about the things that he did behind enemy lines, and he was a highly decorated soldier. And he was drinking, and my mom had to raise these kids, and she couldn't support us, you know, because of his drinking. And so, you know, the Department of Child and Family Services made her divorce my father in order to get assistance. And that was the last thing my mom wanted to do. She's never been with any other man her whole life. She's a devout Catholic, but she had to feed her children. And you know, that house, he was always around, but he was, I know now based on my own experience that he suffered from different, whatever you want to call it, combat stress or post-traumatic stress disorder, things like that, where he would rage and then be remorseful. And as a kid in that household, that dynamic, he would rage and my mom wouldn't talk, and everybody would kind of go and hide in their own corner. And you know, I had a constant fear of not knowing where, you know, for not all the time, but quite often, where our next meal was going to come from, or, you know, when they would, we wouldn't have enough money and food was more important, so the lights would be shut off or the phone would be shut off, or all basic essentials that families, I saw families have outside of that neighborhood, would go to the wayside in order to feed us if they could. And if we couldn't, my mom couldn't feed us, the church would come in and people would bring food. And so living like that, I made a decision at a young age, you know, like I just did not want to live like that. I felt so out of control in my life that I vowed never to be poor. I vowed to work hard. I vowed to never have that happen to me as I grew older. And I ran the streets of that neighborhood with all the gang members before they were gang members. They were my age as a kid. I was born and raised and brought home in that neighborhood. And from the time we grew up and as they entered into the gangs, I had grown up around them. And, you know, I wanted to be hip, slick, and cool like those guys. I wanted to fit in. I always felt anxious and ill at ease. I didn't know what my problem was. But I had an overactive set of emotions, which drove me long before I had a drink. So I was searching for some type of answer quite early in my life. And, you know, I wanted to run around with all those guys. And I hung around with all the guys, all the Mexican guys who entered into their gangs and did whatever. And I had my hair slicked back with three flowers in my hair. And my, if you don't know what that is, it's like this hair gel that all the gang members used to wear and smells like flowers. And I'd have my slingshot and my Pendleton over my arm because I wanted to be cool in the dead of winter. I had one tattoo, so I wouldn't put my Pendleton on even if I was cold because you needed to see it. You know, I'd always like walk towards you with that one tattoo so you could see it doing that. And, you know, and my arms were like this big and my pants were way oversized and pulled up to the middle of my chest. And you know, I just thought I was like the downest guy in that neighborhood. You know, I wanted to fit in, and I really didn't feel like I fit in. And I always hung out with older guys. And the first time I had a few drinks, like where I actually got enough alcohol in me to feel the effects was when we were playing a game one night with a bunch of those older guys, and it was a drinking game and everybody was watching me. So I couldn't just nurse a beer and kind of look cool in the corner because I didn't really enjoy the taste of alcohol. And, you know, I had to drink like three or four glasses, like 4 or 5 ounce glasses of beer in rapid succession. And then all of a sudden the magic happened for me. Like, you know, I've heard it described 100 different ways from this podium. The magic of alcohol when it's ingested into my body, the ability that alcohol has to immediately give me a sense of ease and comfort and change my perception of everyone and everything around me. And alcohol always did that for me. Every time I picked up a drink, you know, I might be happier sometimes or angrier sometimes, but it always altered my perception of how I felt and how you looked, you know, and it was the answer for me. So all those insecurities I had as a kid, all those things of my parents being divorced or my dad raging and being afraid of that or the insecurity as far as food or like our utilities, like all that, it didn't matter. It just didn't matter. Alcohol was the answer. And once I found alcohol and I found the effects of alcohol, I drank as often as I could, as much as I could. And I didn't, I wasn't a daily drinker. I was about 12 years old at that time. But alcohol was easy for me to get in that neighborhood because everybody has a drunk, you know, father who's on the streets, who's out drunk, or uncle or older brother. And alcohol was very socially acceptable in a community like that because people were selling heroin and PCP and people were overdosing and dying. So alcohol, they might scold you for drinking it at a young age, but they were just glad that, you know, they weren't catching you with a needle in your arm. And so there wasn't a lot of consequences, and there was a huge upside. And the huge upside, like I said, was like every time I drank, I felt better about me and I felt better about you, everything in my life. And if alcohol does that for you and you're new tonight, I want to tell you, you're in the right place, right? I mean, if alcohol does that for you, then that's why we, you know, we brave COVID and we come to the meeting and we sit here or they're on Zoom. We do those things because if it does that for you, I have found, at least in my life, the only answer for my alcoholism and the way that I feel is with the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, so my drinking progressed, and I was a daily drinker by the time I was in high school. By the time I was in high school, I had been kicked out of like five schools because I can't keep my hands to myself. I need to fight with everybody because my ego is so involved. I'm so concerned about what my friends think about me that I can't keep my hands to myself. If you look at me wrong, that's a sign of disrespect. A lot of the things I learned in that community as far as survival skills don't really work well out in the real world. But in that environment, they worked very well. And if you looked at me funny, like, you know, I might ask you what you're looking at. I might not. I might just punch you. And I just assume be mistaken and take care of business than to be looked at like a coward, right? So, oops, sorry, my fault. You weren't looking at me, right? And I had a tendency to do that kind of stuff, and I was not a tough guy, but I was more concerned about fitting in with that group of people than I was for my own safety. And that's apparent based on my hospital record in LA. I've been in and out of the hospital, admitted to almost every hospital on the west side of Los Angeles at one time or another for some type of major injury because I had started to run my mouth from, you know, like fighting at a party, waking up with my jaw broken with a 2x4 bruise across the side of my head, you know, where I wandered home drunk and my mom had to take me to the hospital, have my jaw wired shut. I mean, it just goes on and on and on, you know, getting shot twice, getting stabbed, like running my mouth. The insanity of my alcoholism is I will pay any price to feel good, to ingest alcohol in my body and to change my perception of me and you. I'll pay any price. I'll pay physical prices. I'll do whatever it takes. You know, like the insanity of my alcoholism, the night I got shot, and I've shared it to this home group quite a few times. Like I was hanging out with my friends at Venice Pier and I was drinking. There was a couple of girls there and one guy, and a group of guys showed up, like 30 guys, and we knew them. We had fought with, you know, members of that group. I call them a group. The members of that group from time to time. So we were aware of who we were and vice versa. And, you know, like I just figured the fight was on and my adrenaline started pumping and they came up running their mouth and, you know, I knew I was in for a good stomping. So I hit the first guy with a bottle and the fight was on. And by the time that night was over, I'd had a few drinks and I'm worried about what all my friends are going to think about me when they talk about this story. And they're chasing me down the beach and I turn the corner and they're like, everything was, you know, like I knew they were trying to kill me. I could hear them behind me, like chasing me. These guys wanted to kill me. And, as I turned the corner, like out of slow motion, like I saw a guy just kind of standing there, which was weird. Everything went slow motion. And he had his arm extended. And I realized as I turned the corner that he had a gun in his hand. And right as he shot the gun, I got my arm up. He shot towards my face and it hit my arm, broke my arm. And then they chased me down the street and I'm doing what any guy would do from my neighborhood who wants to be respected. When I'm getting stomped on the ground, I'm talking about this guy's mother and sister and brother and like the position I had his mom in the night before and doing everything I can to aggravate this guy, right? And I had had a few drinks that night and I'm going for it. My adrenaline's pumping. And he got mad, you know. I would say he got even madder than he was before I was shot the first time. And they stood back and they shot me again while I laid on the ground. And they were beating me with like tire irons and like steel trash cans off the beach. And you know, the madness of my alcoholism and the insanity of it is, after it was all over. And honestly, I honestly believe, and I said this before, I think he kind of overreacted, you know, to the situation. And I did have a moment of clarity while it was going on, like my life might end. And I mean, I was bleeding so bad. I had my nose broken, my jaw broken. They were stomping me and I would not shut up. I'm that guy that won't shut up. Like, you have to put me out completely unconscious for me to shut up. And as long as I draw breath and I'm conscious, you're going to have to put up with my mouth, even if you're trying to kill me. And the madness of my drinking is that I would have never attributed that to, like, my behavior, right? I defend my right to drink. I had a few drinks. I always pointed the finger at everyone and everything before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. When I came to AA, I had never said – it never crossed my lips before I got to AA, wow, you know, maybe I really had a part in that. That just wasn't in my vocabulary, right? I wasn't one of those guys who wanted to get in touch with my feelings. I mean, if there was a line of people wanting to get in touch with their feelings, I'd be the last guy in that line. I don't want to get in touch with my feelings. I don't want to do any of that stuff. You know, I want to defend my right to drink. And my alcoholism, you know, took off, and I needed to get out of town after I got shot and I joined the Army. Like, you know, I told the story. I came out of the hospital. My eyes were black and blue and my jaw was wired. And I got pins in my arm and I got a bullet in my leg. And there's a recruiting station across the street. And there was a big poster, like an 8-foot poster of a guy like coming out of the water with camouflage and like beads of water on his face with a rifle. And I had another moment of clarity, right? Like what we often do. Like I saw that guy and I thought, you know, he's holding a rifle. And I thought, man, I need a rifle, right? Because I just been shot. I'm like, I need a rifle. How do I get a rifle? So I went over in the recruiting office and they looked at me and, you know, like you, I already described to you how I looked. Do you think they would turn me away? And they didn't turn me away. You know, they teach the recruiters to recognize angry young men when they come in, and I fit the bill. And, you know, and I'm sure there's nobody in this room like I am, but like what I did that day, right, is I took the test and I signed up to join the military for like 8 years, right? Like I like within a couple of days I signed up and I had to wait till I was healed, but I had a date. And I make major decisions, and I'm sure nobody in this room is like that, but I make major decisions about my life for, let's say, the next 8 years based on how I'm feeling in the moment, right? Nobody's done that, right? And so like, you know, I joined the military and I signed up to be a paratrooper in the 82nd Airborne Division. And thank you. And so, you know, like I distinctly have these moments of clarity. Like when they put me on the plane to go to basic training, you can't drink. Everybody's like, looks like you. They're all like shaved heads getting ready to go off to basic training, right? And so they're not serving you because they know you're going to basic training. It's a plane full of recruits. And I realized, like, when I got on that plane, like, I had never been on a plane before, right? I'd never been on an airplane. And, like, I had that moment of clarity. Like, I realized as we were taxiing down the runway that I had an insane fear of flying, right? And I was, like, panicked, and I needed a drink. Like, when I get anxious and overwhelmed, I need a drink. Alcohol has always fixed my anxiety, my less than, my good times, my bad times. And I'm sitting there with a bunch of guys and we're taxiing down the runway and then we start to speed off and I'm having a panic attack, right? And then a thought came into my head right after that was like, hey, you just signed up to jump out of airplanes in the Army. And my second airplane ride was at Fort Benning at jump school. And, you know, they went up to about 800 feet and opened the door and basically said, get out, right? And I'm such a people pleaser. I'm with all the guys in my unit, right? Like, there was guys that were like, no, I'm not doing it. I quit. You know, they quit and they went to, like, straight leg units. And I wasn't going to let that happen because what would they think of me, right? And that's the power of, you know, me wanting to look good. I thought I was going to die every single time I jumped out of an airplane. I jumped out of an airplane 47 times and was absolutely scared to death. And so when I got through jump school, I was stationed at Fort Bragg with the 82nd Airborne Division. And every single time, you know, most of the times I was hungover, so I was feeling the effects of alcohol. We all drank heavy at the 82nd. I could drink there. But still, I wanted to be a jump refusal every time. But I was too worried about, like, what, you know, like I'm sitting next to Johnny Ranger, right? Ranger Tab, all crazy. And what are you going to say? Hey, man, I'm feeling a little nervous. How about you? Like, you just go, airborne, let's go. And, you know, he's like, open the door, let's go, you know. The jackass is what it was. And, you know, and I saw my first stint in combat there. And I remember when I got activated, I jumped into Panama in 1989 as a 19-year-old kid, and I wasn't happy, you know, like my anxiety level when I found out we were really going into combat, like, was through the roof, and I couldn't get a drink, and everybody was like, what's wrong? And like I said, you don't talk to your, I didn't talk to my friends, like, oh, I'm just feeling a little nervous, like, what's going to happen when we get there, and people start shooting at us, and you just don't say that, and I don't have a drink in order to take the edge off, you know, so I'm feeling that anxiety, and the best I could tell them was, look, man, I've been shot. I know what it's like to be shot. And you wait until the first person gets wounded, everybody's going to change their mind about that. And that's one thing about combat. It's a great equalizer of all tough guys. I'll tell you that. I've been in combat twice. And the guys that haven't been and haven't been in that situation, when they get there, the ones that are bumping chests and thinking they're going to be John Wayne, combat is the great equalizer for all tough guys, you know, unless you have some sort of mental illness where you're not scared, you know what I mean? Like you're a sociopath and you just don't care and nothing matters or, but, you know, so we went over there and like, sure enough, I did my job over there, but I'm still judging how I feel on the inside with how, you know, you look on the outside. I did my job like everyone else, and I came home and they pinned medals on me. And my dad, the war hero, wants to walk me around, but I'm ashamed of how I felt. And I didn't know that I could talk to another man about that kind of stuff. I didn't know that was a common theme in combat, right? So I don't know what you do when you feel anxious and overwhelmed and ashamed. I pour alcohol all over the top of it, because that's what I do. That's the answer for everything at that point in my life. And I'm drinking daily, and I'm coming home on leave and kind of withdrawing from my family, and my family wants to hang out with me. And I'm out in the streets drinking and fighting and doing the things I did as a kid. And then when I come home and I'm hungover and I'm coming down to the breakfast table with my mom, who's got her rosary beads and she's praying them with no shirt on. By then, I've already started tattooing my whole body, and I got a half pint in my hand because I need to choke that down so I can get some breakfast in me. Right. And that's the progression of my alcoholism. And then I'm looking at them when, you know, with their eyes are huge. Like, nobody wants to say anything to me. And I'm like, what? Like, what's the problem? You know what I mean? Like, you know, I'm coming down for breakfast. Like, what's the issue? You know, and I was the last to see my alcoholism, you know, and my drinking took off. And, you know, I got out of the military because my dad was dying. And I don't know what to do with myself. And through a strange set of circumstances, like I went back to that corner where I'd been shot and all the guys, they were dying. Like I lost like 15 friends before I was 18 and some after that. Most of them were dying behind violent gang violence or suicide or, you know, behind drugs and alcohol or some sort of violence. You know what I mean? Like, I was like, what's going to happen to me? Like, I just knew I was going to go to prison. You know, everybody's going to prison, catching cases, doing stuff. My brother kind of intervened with a family friend, and he tried to talk me into going to the police academy. And I'm like, nah, I don't want anything to do with the police. Like, I had been the recipient of flashlight therapy for a lot of years by LAPD. And, you know, back when they didn't care, you know, they would just openly smack you around on the streets, and there was no cell phones and stuff like that. Now they're like, sir, can I see your license? You know what I mean? But back then, they grab you by your hair, come here, punk, you know, and smack you around and shove you down, get back in their car and drive off. And those were the good old days, right? And so I went to the police academy and I became a policeman. My drinking was like crazy. I worked in Skid Row and my drinking got so out of control. I mean, I love like being a policeman. I love that environment where my adrenaline is pumping and like man with a gun and like I'm racing and driving my car on the sidewalk to get there. I want to be the first guy there. I want to be standing in the street at like the OK Corral. I want to be standing out there. I mean, I don't want to get shot, but I love the feeling like that adrenaline, right? And so, you know, like I did a good job at work, but off duty, I was drinking like a maniac. And then I was fighting in the streets like I was back on the block, right? Like somebody would say something to me and I'd be like, what are you looking at, punk? And then, you know, then they would raise up and then, you know, I'm fighting in the streets and my gun's falling out on the streets. And, you know, like I'm blackout drinker and I'm getting in trouble with internal affairs. And internal affairs are super uptight people, right? Crazy uptight people. They're like the police of the police. Like they look like I look right now and they're very serious. Like there's no joking with those guys. And but I find myself in front of them in rapid succession while I'm on the job, right? And they're asking me, you know, I'm getting into fist fight in bars and other stuff like that. And I'm coming to work with black eyes and like fat lips and like, you know, people lose their cars in blackouts. I lost my duty gun for like 3 weeks once. I couldn't find it. It's in the bottom of my dirty clothes hamper. I wasn't doing laundry too much back then. That wasn't a priority when I was in the grips of alcoholism, right? And Good thing my brother worked on the shift before me, so he would come off shift and I would grab his gun and put it in my holster and go 10-8. And so I started getting in trouble, and internal affairs is serious. They started reading me my rights. I got a lawyer, and they started asking me those tough questions that those uptight guys ask you, you know, like, what happened, you know? And that's, I mean, I always say that, but it's a joke, right? Like, I'm a blackout drinker. I'm like, you know, well, why don't you give me a hint? Maybe we can piece this together, right? And they are uptight. They don't like that at all whatsoever. So I got fired, right? I got fired because I should have got fired, right? I mean, I'm a liability fighting in the streets. And so I came to AA, you know, I mean, I had been around AA my whole life because my dad had finally sobered up. And I used to say I was in AA, but I wasn't in AA. I hear a lot of stuff about people saying I'm in AA and I know what the right thing is to do. And, you know, I was around AA. I wasn't in AA. I hung around AA. And there's a big difference. And if you're hanging around tonight, I want to encourage you to join AA and not hang around AA. I know what the difference is because I've lived both those lives. And one of them is far more significantly dangerous to you than the other. I'll let you figure out which one that is. But, you know, so I hung around AA and I came to AA finally and got a sponsor. I heard Don N talk and, you know, I came to the Pacific Group. I had been sober a while. I'd been going to all the meetings in Venice with my slingshot and my, you know, for the first like 8 or 9 months of my sobriety before I came to the Pacific Group, you know, my sobriety consisted of like 2 workouts a day, and I weighed like 200 pounds and I was huge. It was all working out and how I looked, and, you know, tank tops in the meeting, all my tattoos, and standing in the back and holding up the walls and like, hey, what's up with all my friends? And, you know, hey, look at that girl, and what's up, and treating it like a dating service. And I'd come late and leave early and get some numbers or go hang out with some girls or do whatever. And then I'd get drunk. Like, I didn't understand it. Like, my friends would get drunk, and then 3 of us would get drunk and 2 would come back. And that's what happens. I've seen it over and over. I've lived it. Like, if you are an alcoholic, it's been my experience that I have watched so many alcoholics come in here who know they're alcoholics, but they don't embrace this program. And they may know the path, because I tell you what, the Pacific Group isn't short on opinions, right? They know the path. Somebody's told them the path. But the path does not take the place. The path in AA does not, knowing the path does not take the place of putting one foot in front of another. The action, the steps, the things we do around here are the things that I have seen people do who have stayed sober for decades around here. And those are the people I follow. Because they're still here, and it tells me that it works. And I came to AA, and I wasn't happy, and I had my tank top and all my tattoos, and I went to the big Wednesday night meeting. I don't know who it was at the door, but they were wearing a bow tie, and they hung onto my hand too long right at the door, and they wouldn't let go. They're like, hey. And they started asking me personal questions like, you know, what's your name and where are you coming from? And, you know, those are personal questions. I don't know you, first of all. Like, I don't like you up in my space. Back up, punk. You know what I mean? And I know how to keep you at arm's length because I'm full of fear, right? And my default is to attack you. That's my default at that point in my life. And I say things like, my name's Charles, and I'm coming from your mother's house. That's where I'm coming from. And they're like, oh, my God. Like, you know, and I'm going back after the meeting, too. And, you know, they're like, oh, my God, you can't talk like that. And then Don N would grab me, and then, you know, Ruben and Don L would try to, oh, come on. And they try to drag me. Oh, you can't do that. And then I'd be pleading my case like a newcomer, like, that punk was holding my hand and he wouldn't let it go. He started asking me personal questions and, you know, just like insanity, right? Like total insanity. So that's who I was when I was new, you know, and I fell in line here and I got actively involved. I've had several sponsors. Tim K's been my sponsor for the last 15 years. Robert helped me quite a bit, Robert Cook, but it clicked with Tim, and he kind of called me on my stuff and said, okay, you know, if you want me to sponsor you, you're not going anywhere else. I was jumping from sponsor to sponsor for a while, and it stuck. And I got actively involved in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I did everything that we do. you know, I went to the yard for years with a lot of those guys that I played cards with. Like, you know, we went to watches, we went to moves, like we showed up when we didn't want to show up. We followed guys like Don Annan and Frank Jay when we were new, and they would come over to Greg and Keith's house, and we'd all meet there after the Wednesday night meeting, a bunch of dumb, crazy newcomers, and have pizza, and the fellowship was alive and well, and I didn't know what I was doing. I felt out of sorts, and I started working these steps, and I started seeing the change in my life, and I started getting a little bit of clarity, you know what I mean? By the time I had like 5 years sober, I'd already run through two marriages, probably two marriages where I shouldn't have had a second date, let alone gotten married, and I had a couple of kids from my second marriage, and, you know, loved them to death, and then Cheryl and I met here in AA, and fell in love and got married. We've been together 21 years, we've been married 19 years, and you know, our lives just got bigger and bigger around here because I was willing to do the things that were uncomfortable in my life, like work the steps, look at my character defects, do those things, help other people, do that kind of stuff in order to feel better. And it got better, you know. And you all know, like, you know, what our family went through. We lost our son 6 years ago, and it was horrible, and it was horrible, and I thought I was carrying that weight alone. And I remember the funeral where there were 800 people, and I stood shaking everyone's hands. And those guys I played cards with were walking through the line and were just devastated because my kid had been raised in AA. And I realized in that moment, while I thought that this loss was our family's loss alone, I realized that everybody felt the loss of Jacob, and that because they felt it, I realized that we could disperse the grief, and I didn't have to carry it alone. And I went through quite a few things that were very difficult: counseling, thoughts of suicide, everything but drinking. And Tim was there, his family was there. They wouldn't allow me to be alone during the holidays. They were incredibly loving. Alcoholics Anonymous is an incredible program. And through all that pain, I grew immensely. I wouldn't wish it on anybody. And I would give up the growth that I had if I could have my son back, but that's not the case. You know, the answer for me at that point was, how do I stay sober? How do I live comfortably? How do I get through this? And God was a big part of it, you know. And so, you know, my life went on, and I'm busy in AA and doing all that stuff. And this is where we get to the train wreck part of my life now. You know, I retired in December. I stayed actively involved in AA, been sober 27 years. And I retired in December at probably the worst time for my career. I was with another guy, a friend of mine. I was running the union, trying to save people's jobs. I was working, you know, ironically, I ended up my last assignment working internal affairs. I know, only in AA, right? And so in December, it all came to an end, right? Like, no AA meetings in person. I retired. I didn't have anywhere to go. My daughter was Zooming for her school. I was at home Zooming. I was done with school. I had finished my undergrad and graduate degree. I couldn't go and be a service. My church was closed. And I started getting crazy, right? Like, getting crazy and having panic attacks. And I didn't know what they were about. Like, full-blown panic attacks again, like when I was new. And I got a little out of hand, and I had to reach out for help, you know? Like, I almost burned my marriage to the ground. My wife wanted a divorce. I say that publicly. I don't like sharing that information, but how I was behaving based on my post-traumatic stress and the anxiety I get when there's fight or flight in my life, like, I feel like every decision I make is life and death, because that's how I've lived my life for so long, that I can't differentiate between an officer needs help call and do you want hamburgers or hot dogs from the market, right? I get the same feeling physiologically in me, and I need that answer so bad that I will push and make my life so miserable to get the answer so I get some semblance of order in my life. And I hurt the people that were closest to me. And at 27 years, I was humbled by this blind spot I had, because just like my alcoholism, right, I was the last to know. I always knew I controlled things, but I felt like I didn't control others. You know, unless you entered my little sphere of influence and then you needed to be controlled, right? Because I need to feel comfortable, and it's destructive. And I turned myself into our sister program that I'm super grateful for. And absolutely the last house on the block for me to go to Al-Anon. Like, I swear to God, like, to, and I tell you what, I have had so much relief from that program based on my feelings and my need to control things. I can't even tell you how grateful I am. So many people have reached out to me. So we're on the mend. I'm back at the VA and I'm working through. They told me that this is a long process because of all the people that I've seen die over my life in combat and on the job, and that I practiced, this is a cool little term they use, avoidance techniques to not deal with it, right? And I said, well, what do you mean avoidance? She said, oh, I don't know, like AA, like busy, like with commitments, helping other people at your church, at your daughter's school, going to school when you didn't even want a degree, going back and getting a second degree. I don't know. What do you think? Maybe that's classic avoidance, right? And I just thought I was killing it, right? Like, she didn't have to rain on my parade like that. And I was seriously humbled to find that I had that big of a blind spot and that I had become my father. And I know, but I'm grateful because of what I learned in this program. I knew that when I picked up that phone that there was nothing that I wouldn't do, whether it saved my marriage or not, whether it did anything to solve this problem in my life, because I felt my feelings were out of control. I think we're all living through some crazy times right now where it's testing our emotional ability to cope. I mean, a lot of us are. And I don't stand up in front of you and tell you this because I'm proud of it. I stand up in front of you and tell you this because it goes to show you that at 27 years, I'm human. You know what I mean? And I'm willing to do whatever it takes to stay sober. And over the last 4 weeks, I feel now, I didn't realize I had applied for a ruler of the universe job and I had gotten it. You know, like I didn't know. And once I realized that, I tendered my resignation. So if any of you are looking for a job, it's available. But it wasn't good for me. And I will tell you that I am grateful for my training in Alcoholics Anonymous because this group particularly taught me that, like, my relief is going to come from doing the hard work. This is just another challenge in my life that I will work through and get to the other side and be able to help somebody else. If you're new, I want to welcome you. I want to tell you you're lucky, whether you're on Zoom or in this meeting, to have made it into this meeting. This is a group of AA activists who know how to guide you down that road and down that path. Please join us. Come enjoy this good life that we have. God bless. Thank you.
We celebrate AA birthdays at this meeting for every 365 days of continuous sobriety. We give a cake with the appropriate number of candles on it. And we define sobriety as freedom from alcohol, pills, pot, or anything which affects you from the neck up. If you are a regular attender of this meeting and like to take a cake with us, please see me at the door before the meeting. And if you're taking a cake tonight, come to the door at the right side of the stage here. Everybody's here. Line up in order of sobriety. If you are taking a cake online, email Kimberly K at birthdays@pacificgroupla.org by noon Wednesday deadline. Hybrid birthdays will be shown after in-person birthdays. We have a custom at the Pacific Group of donating $1 for each candle on our cake. At the end of the year, this candle money is our contribution to AA organizations worldwide. See my assistant at the door when you sign up to take a cake. And now we will sing. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear AAs. Happy birthday to you. Keep coming back. Yeah. And our first birthday is for Danny L. for 1 year.
Hi, Danny, alcoholic addict. I'd like to thank God, my sponsor Andrew, Clancy, PG, AA, and all of you. Thank you.
Our second birthday is for Amy R. for 2 years.
Amy Rose, alcoholic. I'd like to thank my sponsor, Lisa B., my grand sponsor, Mary M., God, Pacific Group, Clancy, my two prior sponsors, April S. and Terry W. Thank you.
Our second year birthday is for Sean N.
Sean, alcoholic, thank you. God, Clancy, and Sean Red McTie.
We have an 8-year birthday for Joe F.
Joe, alcoholic. I'd like to thank God, my sponsor Mitch, my previous sponsors Guy and Josiah, my mom in the Pacific Group. Thank you.
And our last birthday, in-person birthday, is for 49 years for Leonard C.
My name's Leonard. I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to thank Thomas S. for giving me that cake. He's a good friend. And I'd also like to thank my sponsor, Radcliffe L., who doesn't go to in-person meetings these days. And I'd like to thank the Pacific Group. I've been coming here for most of my sobriety for at least 39 years. And I have a lot of friends here that are in person. And it's sure good to see people in person for a change. I don't know how all of us survived the pandemic. And I'm just grateful that I've had such a good life in sobriety and it continues. This has been a difficult year for me, but I'm here and that's what really counts. And I have a relationship with the higher power and thank all of you.
We have one Zoom birthday for Rihanna S., and Yvonne S. is her sponsor. Special announcement, masks. The County of Los Angeles and our landlord, the Women's Club, demand that we wear masks at this meeting. For now, we must do this for the common good.